Hello, everyone. It's October 6th, 2015. We just finished recording a Martian Spoilercast. I want to say thanks at the top of the show to Connor, Steve, and Logan for joining us. It was fun, but it's getting late, so let's return to our regularly scheduled liftoff. And we've cleared the tower. Welcome to episode number 27 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
And I'm Ben.
We just got done doing a really long spoiler cast for The Martian, which is just for our Patreon subscribers.
Yep, chip in a buck and you can listen to us go on and on about about a movie.
I'm usually 99% of my life, I'm the nitpicking nerd who everyone wants to just give it a rest already, like seriously, and I feel bad almost, but I got to be probably, I think you got me beat, so.
There were some really good opinions and observations that I did not, I really, they came out of left field. I did not see them coming. And I really am ready to watch the movie again.
I would really like to see it again, too. I don't know when it's going to be out on DVD.
Well, I want to watch it in 3D now.
See, I don't. I hate 3D, among other things that I hate, which if you listen to our spoiler cast, you will find out some of the things I hate about movies that The Martian did. Although I did love it. I just want to say that. Great film. If you haven't seen it yet, go out and see it, especially if you're planning on listening to the spoiler cast, and you're going to want to see it first.
Yeah, it's not perfect, but it's darn good.
Yeah, definitely good. Definitely
very,
good.
Very entertaining, especially for space geeks.
And one other thing I wanted to bring up, it's not part of our official news because it doesn't quite fall in line with what we talk about on the podcast, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about water on Mars. I just want to say that's cool. I am aware of it. We're not really going to discuss it, but yes, water has been, I guess, at this point, it is confirmed.
Yeah, it's basically really, really, really good evidence. We haven't seen flowing water, but we've seen a smoking gun, so.
I'm sure that there's, because I listen to a bunch of podcasts, and I'm going to be hearing about it on all of them. Unfortunately, this isn't quite that podcast, but we're going to talk about some other interesting things. First up, as always, this week in spaceflight history.
Yeah, so the date is 15 October 1997. You know, I think I might have said 1977 in last week's show. Do you know if I did that?
I don't actually, but if so, then...
Well, it's the kind of thing that I would switch around, if you haven't noticed that already. And I say this because Animated Sky on Twitter said the launch of Voyager 1 on September 5th, 1997. I mean, come on! And that's incorrect. We also had incorrect answers from Dr. Merkverdegliba. Did I do that right?
Yeah, close.
Verdegliba. Perfect accent. He actually, you know what, drop in audio of him pronouncing his own name because he sent that to us. And then we also had an incorrect answer from Jace Pearson, who is a guy I know in real life. He works for the Challenger Center down in Sacramento, which is so cool. If there's a Challenger Center near you, go to a community mission. I promise you'll enjoy it. But the actual answer, 15th of October 1997 is the launch of Cassini-Huygens, particularly on a Titan IVb. It's a double meaning there. Mission to Titan and launched on a Titan. If you remember, the clue said it was a Titanic undertaking or something like that. Yeah, Cassini-Huygens headed out towards Saturn. Cool name I picked up on the way. That's a chronocentric orbit. So would that be Parachrone and Apochrone?
I suppose it would. Or para... I'm getting my...
Would it be the Latin, not the Greek?
Yeah, I'm getting my gods mixed up. It's just... Yeah, I don't know how you'd say that.
I think it's Chronos because all the other ones are Greek and Chronos is Greek. So anyway, so there's so much here to talk about that I'm not going to tell you everything about Cassini. I wish I could. But Cassini was born of the flagship program. Keep that in mind because we'll talk about that later. And Cassini so far has done more science than we could ever cover in an episode. Such an amazing program. One of the things that's often overlooked, Cassini-Huygens, is the Huygens lander, which is really crazy because it's the only landing we've ever performed in an outer solar system body. We have photos of the surface of Titan. In fact, we probably have images of ice on the surface. There are like little boulders on the surface that they believe are water ice. Huygens was also built. We basically had no idea what it was going to land on, so they made it capable of a water landing, which I didn't know. I think that's pretty cool. So Cassini is nearing its end of life. On September 15th of 2017, it will dive into Saturn's atmosphere and end its life. Before it does that, it's going to do a very close pass through the ring belt, which is ring belt. Boy. Through the rings.
Well, you could call it a ring belt.
Yeah, whatever. It's going to fly straight through the rings, which is something that we have tried very hard not to do so far. far because it's the kind of thing that can kill a probe very easily, but they're going to go ahead and do it because they're going to kill it anyway. So yeah, no winners from this week. So here's your clue. Next week in 2003, I wrote this. I think there's probably a better clue out there, but I said a sky submarine goes on a cruise.
Yeah, that's very evocative.
Yeah, knowing your languages would be helpful on this one. So go ahead and submit your guesses on Twitter using hashtag ThisWeekSF, or send us an email at thisweek@theorbitalmechanics.com.
As we speak, I'm looking at some of the answers we got, and they're all, they would be guesses consistent with you having said 1977. So I'm thinking that that might be what happened here. So
I'm sorry, folks.
Because we also have release of the STS flight assignment baseline, which obviously would not happen in 1997, as well as first mission to Salyut 6, failed docking.
You know, I thought for sure that we said the date multiple times. I don't know. I'm more than happy to take the blame on myself because I'm really bad at this kind of thing.
But yeah, we got it right this time. 2003, Sky Submarine goes on a cruise. All right, so let's do some news. First up, HTV-5 has departure hiccup, so which I think is the only thing of note, or the only off nominal thing, I suppose, right?
Well, there was a very, very super awesomely nominal thing, right? The plush HTV-5 that they brought up on this flight, that's like the best thing of all time. Did you see photos of that?
I did not. They brought up a plush, like an actual plushie.
It's a little plush toy, and it's got a big old grin on its face, and it's yellow, and it looks just like an HTV.
That's cute, and probably doesn't weigh too much either, since it's a little plush, so.
Yeah, it's really cool. So yeah, HTV-5 had a fantastic mission, despite a little weather delay, right?
Yeah.
For launch. But basically, Canada Arm unberths HTV-5. That goes just fine. It goes out to the release point, and that's fine. And then it tries to let go, and nothing happens. So what they think happened was that there was some sort of safing event, basically where the arm thought that something was wrong and decided to just freeze. And the problem appears to be in the RWS in the cupola, that's the robotic workstation, because they headed down to the secondary RWS in Destiny, and then a news source, I believe it was NASA Spaceflight, said that the primary RWS in the cupola came back online. So it looks like it was probably a problem with one of the computers in there. In any case, they were able to release it within the first window, but the space weather forecast, and probably it probably had more to do with their location on Earth. In any event, they were expected to have pretty ratty comms, and so they decided to just wait until the next release window, and then so that, you know, basically go around the Earth once. And when they came back to the window, they released it just fine, and HTV-5 had a nice little, you know, funeral pyre as it burned up in the sky. Yeah, not much to say. I mean, it's kind of interesting to see these little hiccups, but it was just fine. And honestly, if they didn't have another window, if that was their only window, they would have been able to release it as well. They just took a lot of caution.
Well, and the only thing that really specifies what that window can be, I would imagine, since it's just going to burn up, is you want it to burn up over an ocean.
Bingo.
Because if not, then you could release it really anywhere. I wonder how much of it even makes it back to the ground. I'm guessing none at all, or maybe some scraps.
Yeah, none at all. I think you want it to be able to burn up over an ocean. I think you want to be able to observe it burning up. I mean, even if you did it over land, you probably don't want to do it where a bunch of people can see it, because that's kind of terrifying.
I suppose that might be the reason. Yeah, you don't want to terrify the villagers.
Right.
So the next story, the next thing we have here, Discovery down select. We have a plethora of notes. You really want to go into this one, so this is going to take up a little bit of time here.
This isn't going to be too bad. So earlier we talked about how Cassini was a flagship. They call it a flagship class, I believe.
Mm-hmm, yep.
So basically the way that this works is NASA has a couple of different programs that they run that all have different focuses. Flagship is now over, I believe, and that was really about big missions going and doing big important things and getting huge returns on investment. Discovery is more focused on low cost. So it started in 1992, and all it's trying to do is get missions out on a regular basis, and it's got a cost cap on each of those missions. And like the other programs, it accepts proposals in huge batches, and then slowly whittles that down to ultimately just one mission. So we're now on Discovery 13. For this launch, all of the proposals have to be buildable within a time frame so that they can be launched by 2021. We're hoping that this vehicle will actually fly in 2020, but there's a chance that it might slip and fall back farther. It really depends on where it's going. So Discovery is a really big program. Obviously, since we're up to 13, it's had a lot of flights. I just had a couple here that are big names that people will recognize. Pathfinder was Discovery number 1. Messenger was number 7. Dawn was number 9. Kepler, the amazing space telescope, was number 10. InSight is number 12. That one hasn't flown yet. That is a lander going to Mars. And it's not a rover, it's just a lander. That ought to be pretty cool. And then, of course, we're working on choosing Discovery 13. So this down select was a really stressful time for a lot of people. Do you follow any astrophysicists or space scientists on Twitter?
Some. My own personal Twitter, I rarely ever log on anymore because I'm busy with you know, the podcast. So that's about
okay,
it.
Okay, let me ask it a different way. Did you see any space scientists stressing out over this last week?
I want to say no. Nothing jumped out at me. I'm sure that they were. So who was stressing out?
Basically anybody who had anything to do with any of these missions. Because they went from a big list, I think it was over 20, and now they're down to 5. And a lot of people were like, well, I've got an instrument on that one, and I've got a secondary mission on that one, and, you know, really, really hope that my mission gets chosen. So the missions that got chosen, I'm just going to run pretty quick down this list. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So the missions that are now in contention are Da Vinci, which stands for Deep Atmosphere, Venus Investigation of Noble Gases, Chemistry, and Imaging. Boy, that's a tortured acronym. And Da Vinci is going to be studying the chemical composition of Venus's atmosphere during a 63-minute descent. So we must have some aerodynamic surfaces or something on that vehicle.
Well, the atmosphere is just so thick that it might just take that long.
You think
you know?
With parachutes it'll take an hour to get down?
It could. I mean, it's, what is it? I can't remember. It's very dense. I mean, the atmosphere is, and hot. I mean, at least once you get towards the surface. So it's, yeah. I'm sure it's not going to last for very long.
I wouldn't
long.
Be surprised if they had like balloons or something on it to slow it down really slow. Anyway, so that's Da Vinci. The next one is called Veritas. This is the Venus Emissivity Radio Science InSAR Topography and Spectroscopy Mission, Veritas.
Oh, another good acronym.
And that's even more tortured than Da Vinci. And that's going to be producing global high resolution topography and imaging of Venus's surface and produce the first maps of deformation and global surface composition. That's cool. There's also Psyche, which is going to go fly out to the asteroid Psyche. So they believe that Psyche is the survivor of what they call a violent hit and run with another object. And so it was all geared up to become a planet. Then it had all of its loose stuff knocked off. So what they think it is just like a floating planetary core. So they're going to go check that out. I think that's pretty neat. NEOCAM, honestly, as fantastic as all of these are, I think NEOCAM really needs to be built one way or the other. And if it happens to be built in place of a discovery, another discovery potential, I'm kind of okay with that. NEOCAM stands for Near Earth Object Camera. And their goal is to discover 10 times more near Earth objects than all the NEOs discovered to date. And let's be clear, we haven't discovered that many. We've discovered, I think, millions, but that's a small fraction of the near-Earth objects, and we really, really, really need to find as many of these as we can, and 10 times more than we already have cataloged sounds like something in the right area. Like, that sounds pretty good to me.
Well, why do you think personally we need to discover more of them? Or what's the number one reason for you?
They're going
to
destroy Earth.
Okay. Well, Earth is still here, so I don't know if they're going to destroy it because they've had plenty of time to do so, but yeah.
Well, they've had plenty of time to do so, but remember that their orbits are not well aligned with Earth's, and we get near misses that we had no idea that were coming.
Yeah, that happens all the time, actually.
And every time that we have a near miss, that asteroid's orbit is perturbed more than usual, which means that it could very easily come back and hit us a second time. This is a real danger. We are, as a species, we are at huge risk. We're more at risk of destroying our own planet, obviously, because we've more or less already done that. But yeah, something is going to come in sooner or later. I think we're due for a big one in the next 1,000 years or something. Like, there's a big one coming, statistically speaking, and we don't know where it is, and we need to. Not that we can do anything about it right now, but...
Yeah, well, if given enough time, then certainly I'm sure there are things that can be done about it.
You know, if we saw it coming and we knew it was going to hit us, there was a 50% chance it was going to hit us, I'm sure we'd take care of it.
And just as you said, it is a question of, well, you didn't say, but it is simply put a question of when, not if. I mean, yeah, it is going to happen eventually. So could be tomorrow. It could be 10,000 years from now. So
I don't think it's going to be 10,000. I think that's being generous.
Well, I mean, the big ones that destroy civilization. Well, I can't say that because our civilization hasn't been around for that long. But yeah. Big ones that wipe out whole species, those are actually extremely rare.
Species killers are pretty rare. But remember that our civilization is teetering on the edge of viability as it is. One good solar storm and we can't talk to each other and people start dying. You know, it doesn't take much. And then the fifth mission is called Lucy. And I don't think that has an acronym. Lucy is going to be performing the first reconnaissance of the Jupiter Trojan asteroids. If you don't know about Jupiter Trojan asteroids, go look them up on YouTube. There's some really cool animations showing their orbits. But basically, I think Lucy is just going to be observing. I don't think it's going to be visiting any of them. But the more we know about them, the more we know about our solar system, because I think there's a lot of history there, basically. And if you know where all those are, you can begin to judge where they came from. I think that's a basic idea. But Lucy is looking into system formation, which is pretty cool.
That's the list in its entirety. Which one are you rooting for the most? Is it the NeoCam?
Yeah, NeoCam, and I think a close second is probably going to have to be Da Vinci, just because that's cool. But I would be very happy to see any of these fly. I think this is a really cool list.
Just like you said, NeoCam is arguably the most important one, but same thing. I think Da Vinci is probably, that one sounds the most exciting. I think anything having to do with Venus is pretty cool because it's such a mysterious, shrouded in thick layers of gas kind of a planet, you know?
And it's very similar to Earth.
It is. It's hard to imagine that there's a whole other sort of Earth out there, but it's just deadly inhospitable. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a whole planet that just sits under this boiling hot cushion of carbon dioxide where lead flows like water. So, yep, those are the missions. When are they going to make a final decision? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I didn't look that up.
I'm just wondering if it's going to be in the next couple of years or...
Yes.
It'll probably be soon that they finally make that decision because they have to get underway with, you know, preparing. So, all right. With that said, let's move on to our next story. This one, I couldn't find much on this, but apparently it's true. There was someone had sent, I think it was Mini Elon, as is often the case. He sends us stuff all the time. He sent a link to the Wall Street Journal, and they had an interesting article on Lockheed getting eliminated from CRS-2 or the CRS-2 contract, not the CRS-2 mission, which has already happened.
Twice it's happened.
They need to come up with another acronym, and perhaps they have, and this is just a short version of it. But
it's actually COTS is what the...
COTS, right, yeah. Well, it said CRS-2 in the Wall Street Journal, but I'm sure they just got that wrong. Yeah, COTS 2. So Lockheed Martin was eliminated from COTS 2. There are still many other competitors out there. But before I talk about that, this contract is for 2018 through 2024. So that's the span of time during which whoever the eventual supplier ends up being will be supplying the International Space Station. We had talked about, probably on episode 4 or 5, I want to say, is it Lockheed Martin still? It is still Lockheed Martin, right?
Because yeah,
it says Lockheed, because it always gets shortened to Lockheed. So Lockheed Martin's concept, this was the one that it's a pretty crazy one. It is the Jupiter tug. We haven't really talked about it since that last time that we had discussed it all those episodes ago. This is where they would have a little tug type of vehicle which would remain in orbit, and it would simply pick up something called the Exoliner, which is where you keep all of the cargo, and it would move it to and from the International Space Station. And the idea is you keep all the expensive stuff on the tug so that it does not have to burn up in the atmosphere. Instead, it would simply burn up the Exoliner itself, which is more or less a big empty can. At least that's the concept. And I remember you having a lot of doubts about this because there's, you know, I mean, and this is a very new concept. They would have to build, I believe, the Jupiter tug. Do you remember? I might be wrong here. Was this the one that was going to have what is essentially a lawnmower engine in it? Remember that? I don't know if
yeah,
you remember
no,
that.
That was Vulcan, the Vulcan uppers. Yeah.
Oh, Vulcan, yeah, you're right. Vulcan upper stage. Okay, you're right. Okay.
Boy, that's such a funny idea. I I love the idea of a lawnmower engine in space.
Yeah. So Jupiter Tug, I think, just used more standard means of propulsion.
Yeah, it was pretty conventional, but I mean, there was a robotic arm on it for what that's worth.
Yeah, it had to use the arm to berth and unberth the Exoliner. So they've been cut from the down select process. So I guess this means that this is the end of the whole Jupiter Tug concept, or maybe at some point they'll bring it back if they have any reason to, but
yeah, who knows?
I guess for right now they don't. So who's left in the running? We still have SpaceX and Orbital ATK, Sierra Nevada, and Boeing. Yeah, it's still up for grabs. And the thought is, because this is still coming from a lot of inside sources, there's not a lot of information, but it's thought that the reason why they were cut was for cost reasons, which wouldn't be surprising. I'm thinking that something like this whole Jupiter Tug system, because it's such a new concept, it would almost certainly cost more money than something more conventional, such as the services that SpaceX offers.
Yep.
Plus, there's just, I would think there's too many unknowns. I mean, you're trying to resupply the ISS, and we've already had so many hiccups with very well-proven vehicles. I'm not sure I would want to rely on something like this for that.
Yeah, the idea definitely has merit, but I don't know why you would particularly want to do that just going to ISS. I don't know. Maybe I don't understand the concept well enough, but it just doesn't make that much sense to me.
Well, I seem to recall you saying something similar, that maybe not for ISS, but it might very well have merit for other applications. And I believe that, I just don't remember now, but I believe that there are some other ideas, or that there are some other reasons that they have. I just don't recall what they are, but the Jupiter Tug might be good for something else.
And I know that we will learn from it, right? Which is a really important thing in space. We would learn from that kind of a system.
I do remember a criticism you had was that it would have to remain on orbit for quite some time. And, you know, over time, things might start going wrong. So how long could something like this survive? I mean, how many missions, how many iterations could it survive before it either ran out of fuel, which I believe it would refuel from the Exoliner itself.
Yeah.
But, you know, all of those hypergolic engines and so forth.
Well, those are things that we need to learn. We need to learn how to have things in space for a heck of a long time.
And that's what I think really interests me the most, is that this is something that could be up there for a long time. I mean, I don't think there's anything else that's even on the table for operating in space for that length of time.
Other than station, yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. But the station doesn't really go anywhere. It just, you know, maintains its orbit. But this is a little tugboat in space. So let's move to this last one. This story, just a quick one. I just kind of wanted to mention it mostly just to say congratulations to ULA. So they have had 100 successful launches. I think that's pretty amazing, because I don't think there's any other company or launch provider in America that has done so.
Nope.
Or Europe, for that matter, right? Maybe the Chinese have, but I kind of doubt that actually as well. I'm not sure.
Well, certainly not 100 successful launches in a row.
And that's what I'm saying, is it's 100 in a row. And indeed, it's 100 successful launches since its inception. So really, they haven't had any failures at all, except for one partial failure, which I had to look up. Back in 2007, they had a problem with a center upper stage. It shut down a little bit early, and they weren't quite able to get two National Reconnaissance Office satellites into orbit. I think that's what the O stands for. But that was still deemed a success. So 100 launches and all of them successful. That's pretty impressive. And as much as we like to criticize ULA, you kind of have to give them credit there. They are, statistically speaking, the most reliable launch provider out there. I don't think that there's anyone better, to be honest. Definitely cheaper, but not any more reliable, I would say.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, just because I know we give ULA a hard time. So good going, ULA.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
Questions, comments, and corrections. And speaking of ULA, this is pretty cool. I think you had read this first, and you had told us to go take a look at it. You had told me to, hey, go check out what someone sent us on Reddit.
Yeah, so Ethan829, who's been a listener since almost the very beginning, Ethan happens to be a moderator over on /r/ULA. And to celebrate the 100th launch, they are having an AMA, definitely with Tory Bruno, and he's the, you know, the president and CEO of ULA, as well as they're hoping to get Dr. George Sowers. So that's going to be really, really cool. The AMA will be taking place on October 14th at 6 p.m. EDT. I believe that they will have announced it. I think they've already announced it as we're recording the show, but they asked us to talk about it, and I am super happy to do that, because that's going to be really good. So go over there, be polite, polite. If I catch anybody being mean over there, you seriously, you're going to be banned from my sub. That's the way it's going to happen. But I don't expect anybody's not going to be nice, because even though we trash ULA all the time on this show, obviously they're doing amazing work. So
yeah, as evidenced by their perfect record so far. Do you have a question that you would like to ask of Tori Bruno?
I don't think so. I don't think that I would have any questions that he'd be interested in answering.
Really? I wonder what that means.
Oh, just because the questions I have are stuff that he probably isn't involved in. If he was, they're probably trade secrets. So
I think I probably have similar questions. Yeah, stuff that he probably wouldn't want to answer. But nonetheless, I'm going to be checking it out. And if something comes to mind, I'm totally going to put it up there and see if I get a response. I don't know if I've ever gotten a response during any kind of an AMA, although I haven't, you know, looked at too many of them. I think I asked a couple questions of Elon Musk, didn't get a response, but that's only because he got thousands.
He was bombarded. Yeah,
wasn't going to happen. And so the next thing we have here is an actual, I guess a correction. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. More of an elaboration, but sure.
Yeah, right. What was it? It was about 3 or 4 episodes back now, I suppose. You had mentioned the Air Force pre-1947. So we got a response from, how do you say this? The Juche did this?
I would say user the Juche did this.
Okay, yeah, we got some weird names for people, so this makes it confusing. So we have a user gave us a correction on our subreddit. The name is the Juche, J-U-C-H-E, did this. So apparently the United States Air Force prior to 1947 was called the U.S. Army Air Corps, which is kind of what I had in mind. I think I said something like the Airborne Wing of the something Cavalry. I was just making stuff up as I went along, but this is what it is actually called, as it turns out.
So I Googled Juche. It's translated, it's Korean for self-reliance, and it's the official political ideology of North Korea.
But a word that short, you know, that could be German. Could totally be Juche. I don't know. I'm just guessing, but.
Hang on. I'm going to look it up. Hang on. It's pronounced Juche. Juche.
Juche.
Yeah. I threw it into Google Translate and it said Juche. I know nothing about Korean pronunciation, so.
Me neither.
I'm just echoing a robot.
And what's our last thing we have?
This is a really cool last little note to end on here. So a user named Animated Sky kind of took up our challenge to create a podcast that's just about the ISS daily reports. So it's up on SoundCloud. We'll link to it in the show notes, and it's also in our subreddit. He posted a link to it. But he's basically just reading through the end of day science logs. He's doing a little bit of commentation, which is cool. You know, if you're a big ISS geek like me and you want to stay up to date on all the little tiny things that they're doing, go ahead and listen to this show. It's really good.
Yeah, so I gave it a listen and it sounds really good. It's got good production quality. The only thing it needs, right, is it needs an RSS feed.
It has one. What he basically did was SoundCloud's got a beta program where they'll generate an RSS feed for you, and he was able to get in there. So he does have an RSS feed. And he's got like 5 episodes up. So he's been doing this every day, more or less. This is fantastic. This is not an easy thing to do. And I know that with all the practice he's getting, he's going to be really good at podcasting. He's going to be better at podcasting than we are very shortly.
That's probably not saying much. I mean, he's doing a really good job. I have to say I'm impressed. And I'm amazed that, cause, you know, we didn't really put a challenge out there. We were just making sort of like an offhand comment more than anything. And then someone actually said, hey, I'm going to actually do that. I'm going to make it happen. I mean, how often does that happen? A podcast was born because you and I were just sort of, you know, kind of riffing.
We made an internet child.
A little podcast baby. Okay. Well, so I guess that's
it is
all.
Late, isn't it?
Yeah, it is getting late. Oh my goodness, late on a Saturday night. So yep, those are all the questions, comments, corrections, and other miscellaneous things. Cause it's not just questions, comments, and corrections, really. I'll have to put a fourth word in there, but that's what we got for this week. So I guess now we can do upcoming spaceflight events. First one we have up is a Long March 2D, launching Jilin 1, launching from Area 4 ? And that is the Jiuquan Launch Center.
Yeah, we talked about this last time. I think this got delayed. So this is now delayed to October 7th. 0400 hours to 0445 hours UTC, but it doesn't matter because it's China, so you can't watch it. A launch that you can watch is an Atlas 5 401 in the 401 configuration is launching NROL 55 on October 8th, and that will be flying hopefully at 1200 hours UTC. That's flying out of Vandenberg. This one's really cool because it is an NROL reconnaissance orbiter or reconnaissance office vehicle, so super secret, but there are a ton of CubeSats which are doing a you know, kind of a secondary payload kind of thing. So that should be pretty good.
It's not a literal ton, is it?
I highly doubt it.
Probably not. And next one up, on October 13th, a Proton M with a Breeze M upper stage is launching Turksat 4B. So pretty standard, launching from Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. And that will be launching at 2044 hours UTC. I guess it's time to wrap up the podcast, huh? This is maybe perhaps one of the shorter ones that we've done, but that's only because we just got done talking about the Martian for 2 hours, which, as I said, if you want to listen to it, what was it, Ben? A buck? That's not much, is it?
A buck a month. That's all you got to pay.
For half the price of a cup of coffee at this point. So,
so those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
Cool. All right. Well, let's close it out then. Let's deorbit the show and let's cue the music, of course, which is brought to you by Ronald Jenkins, of course, and check him out at ronaldjenkins.com.
Of course. And if you like this episode, please review us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Of course. And if you enjoyed our show, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/orbitalpodcast.
There's one flight director position open. If you want to get on our Slack, there's still a position open. You can connect with us on Twitter and Reddit at Orbital Podcast.
You can send questions and comments to info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
All right, we're done. I'm going to go to bed, so we will see you all in a week on orbit. Until then, later.
Good night.
So, wie Sie Ihren Namen sagen?
Dr. Merkwürdig Liebe.